By way of background, I'm a physiologist, and I know very little about the brain because I've been devoting almost all of my research career to studying lymphatic vessels. And interestingly enough, we were interested in the extracellular fluid regulation of the brain and cerebrospinal fluid. And we started to do some experiments 10 or 15 years ago now, asking the question whether lymphatics have any role in CSF absorption. And we found indeed that they did. In fact, we find actually very little evidence that the arachnoid granulations and villi have a role, at least in the species that we studied. But I actually don't want to talk about the lymphatic uptake particularly today, except to point out a couple of recent studies that caused me some discomfort with some of the preconceived notions that I had about hydrocephalus and whether indeed it relates to a CSF absorption deficit directly. And just to fill you in a little bit, lymphatics and CSF come in contact at a great many locations extracranially, but the dominant site seems to be at the level of the olfactory bulbs. So CSF convex forward to the olfactory bulbs. Some of it ends up passing through the cribriform plate foramina in association with the olfactory nerves, and it enters an extensive network of lymphatics in the nasal mucosa. The logical extension of our basic physiological studies was to ask some simple questions about whether this had any relevance to disease. And we took up two studies, both of which are finished now. One, we looked at aging rats, and we quantified the uptake into lymphatics compared with young rats. And then in collaboration with Pat McAllister's group, we looked at Kaolin hydrocephalus model that Pat's already talked about and asked whether there was some deficit in lymphatic uptake there. And I'll just very briefly give you the results. Certainly in the case of the aging rat, based on our method of looking at this, there was a very significant reduction in the transport of CSF across the cribriform plate into lymphatics in these older animals. And this may have something to do with the elevated CSF outflow resistance that has been documented in humans. And as Pat just mentioned, Dr. Silverberg believes that this contributes, along with reductions in CSF formation, to a stagnation of CSF in the elderly. So there may be a lymphatic component to that as well. In terms of Kaolin hydrocephalus, it was absolutely clear that in our Kaolin-injected animals, there was a very marked reduction in the lymphatic uptake of our tracer, anyway. And when we plotted the ventricular volume versus lymphatic uptake, we got this sort of curious curve, which tends to suggest that in this model, at least, the ventricles don't expand until almost all of the lymphatic function is compromised. So one might immediately jump to the conclusion that lymphatics were really important in causing hydrocephalus. But unfortunately, and it pains me to say this, this is probably not the case, at least not directly. We still do not know what the mechanism is that's responsible for our observations. We have a number of possibilities, and we're working on that. But as we've heard today and this morning in particular, there are all kinds of more fundamental issues. Conceptually, if you were to block CSF absorption at any site, would the ventricles expand? I'll come back to that in a minute. What is the nature of the pressure gradients? How are they formed? We really don't understand that very well. How much gradient is required to expand the ventricles, and over what period must the gradient exist? These are all issues that I don't think have immediate answers. Certainly from a lymphatic perspective, it's very difficult to see how a blockage, say, at the cribriform plate could cause the ventricles to expand, because you would expect the ICP to go up equally in the subarachnoid space as well as the ventricles. So I can't imagine how that would necessarily form a gradient. Certainly, one can argue that it would increase ICP, and we know this. We've directly tested this in sheep. And possibly it may change the compliance, and we've heard a little bit about redistribution of pulsatility, so it may contribute to the effect that Dr. Egnor has talked about. But I really don't want to talk about any of these things, I want to talk about another concept that is not new, and that is perhaps the gradient of interest is not transmantle, but under some circumstances, transparenchymal, from the ventricle into the periventricular area. And how the lymphatics relate to this, we don't know, but it could be that when lymphatics or arachnoid villi are obstructed by any mechanism, it just makes matters worse. So it may be a concurrent pathology. So how might this occur? And the reason we've gotten interested in it is because Rolf Reed in Bergen, Norway, did some, I think, fascinating experiments in non-CNS tissues, in which he demonstrated very convincingly that the interstitial matrix plays a very active role in tissue pressure regulation. And these are a few of the classic references. And the reason he was interested in this, he studied inflammation for many years, was the fact that if you take a steady state situation and you plug in all of the numbers in the Starling equation and you estimate under certain inflammatory conditions how much water would enter the interstitial space, what you find is that it underestimates it by a tremendous amount. And he was trying to understand how this occurs. And he did the following experiments that I find fascinating. With a servo-null micropipette technique, he measured interstitial fluid pressure in the rat. And, of course, in subcutaneous tissues, it's subatmospheric to begin with. And in an intact circulatory system, intact animal, the animal's alive, with an inflammatory reaction, in this case a dextran anaphylaxis, the interstitial pressure goes up, which is sort of what you expect because you get a change in permeability, water moves into the tissue spaces. However, when you induce circulatory arrest, he found quite the opposite. The interstitial fluid pressure dropped quite considerably. And this is important, the circulatory arrest which he induced with KCL. This is important because what he was able to do was unmask the drop in interstitial fluid pressure by preventing water moving from the vasculature into the tissue spaces, which essentially would have masked the change in tissue pressure. Now, he would never admit it to me, but I'm pretty certain that he discovered this by just having a couple of his animals died when he had the micropipette in the tissue. That certainly would have happened if I would have discovered this thing. But he would never tell me the truth. He thought that it was all planned experiment. The truly remarkable thing is the magnitude of the pressure drop that can occur under some circumstances. For example, in a burn injury, take a look at that number. Pressure dropped to below minus 120 millimeters of mercury. That's truly astonishing. So this mechanism, then, is very powerful. And I don't have time to go into all of the experiments that he performed, but the key to all of this seems to be the beta-1 integrins, because when you disrupt the beta-1 integrins with antibodies just injected subdermally, again under conditions of circulatory arrest, you get a drop in interstitial fluid pressure. I should point out that in a living animal, when you inject an antibody to the beta-1 integrins, you get edema formation at the site. So what he believes happens then, again in the periphery, is that the cells through the beta-1 integrin receptors bind to the surrounding hyaluronan and proteoglycans and collagens and so on to keep the interstitium in a kind of condensed state. When you disrupt these bonds, basically the interstitium springs open and you get a transient lowering of the tissue fluid pressure until water moves in to balance the Starling forces. And to come back to this intact versus heart stop situation, in his case, of course, in the intact situation, you would never notice the drop in tissue pressure because water would move in and fill up the tissue spaces at the same time. And perhaps there's a message here for those of us that are interested in the whole concept of pressure gradients. Because we don't measure them immediately doesn't mean they don't exist. In Rolf Reed's case, he had to go to these extra lengths to find them. So if you now unmask this effect by causing circulatory arrest in the periphery, the water then doesn't move from the capillary because capillary pressures are essentially zero. The interstitium expands, and you can now measure the drop in tissue fluid pressure. And this was very important in the problem that Rolf Reed was interested in, because this gradient, the PMV, the microvascular hydrostatic pressure minus the interstitial fluid pressure, this gradient was enormously large compared with the gradient that you would estimate based on the steady state data. So, does this have any relevance to the brain? Well, the short answer is I don't know, but first of all, there are lots of beta-1 integrins in the brain. They're everywhere. In the periventricular area, gray matter, cerebral cortex, I won't read all this out. But what's especially interesting is the fact that you can disrupt the matrix and the beta-1 integrin bonds using a variety of different techniques. If you induce an inflammatory response, if you inject cytokines, the various prostaglandins apparently are very potent in inducing this effect, cerebral ischemia, and I just added this as a possibility. There are genetic anomalies in every system, and it's possible that there are anomalies in the formation of the integrins as well. So, of course, if this were to have any relevance to the brain, the situation is a little bit different. If the beta-1 integrin bonds, say, were disrupted in the periventricular area, presumably not much water would move from the capillary because of the blood-brain barrier, the hydraulic conductivity of brain capillaries being much lower than in the peripheral circulation. But it might be that water could move from the CSF system into the periventricular area. And this might contribute possibly, theoretically, to the periventricular edema that some people have observed. Okay, so we've done a few very quick and dirty experiments, and the data has just really come to light in really the last few weeks. We haven't done all the appropriate controls, but we put a summer student on it, and she's been injecting antibodies to the beta-1 integrins into the lateral ventricles in adult rats, and ask a simple question, what happens? And oddly enough, we see ventricular enlargement in the vast majority of them. We have a polyclonal antibody to beta-1 and a monoclonal antibody to the alpha-2 beta-1, and these are similar antibodies to the ones that Rolf Reed used in his experiments. And you can see not all the animals have enlarged ventricles, but many of them do. Now, when I say enlarged ventricles, they're not huge, but they're sort of the same order of magnitude that we saw with the kale and hydrocephalus rats. So here's a typical control, and I think that this is reasonably impressive expansion. In this particular example, this is an antibody to the alpha-2 beta-1. Here's an example of polyclonal antibody to the anti-beta-1 integrins. So not a vast hydrocephalus, but certainly seems to be expanded relative to normals. So what is the next step then? Obviously, we've got to do this more carefully. We need to do all the appropriate controls, and some of those are being done as we speak. But what we really want to do is utilize this micropipette servo null technique that we now have in our lab. I don't know if you're familiar with this method, but you pull pipettes to about a 2-micron tip, and you fill the pipette up with sodium chloride, and you use the electrical impedance measured at the tip to estimate pressures. And there's a dual servo nulling system, so when you puncture a tissue, and this method was originally designed to measure intracapillary pressures. So it's also very useful for tissue pressures. But what happens is if the pressure in the tissue is greater than the pressure in the micropipette, it pushes the sodium chloride up, changes the electrical impedance, a positive pressure pump comes on, pushes back, and the pressure required to reestablish the equilibrium initial pressure is deduced as being equivalent to the pressure in the tissue that you punctured. And this is a servo null recording of the pressure in a rat brain, and you know, you get nice pulsatility and so on. What we're hoping to do, ours is a dual servo null system, is to simultaneously measure the pressure in a lateral ventricle and in the periventricular area under a number of experimental conditions. We will try to duplicate what Rolf Reed did, putting in antibodies to the beta-1 integrins, with and without the animal being alive. We'll try to manipulate the CSF pressure to perhaps lower that pressure so that the water that may cascade in from the ventricle doesn't mask any potential tissue pressure effects that we can measure. And in addition, in other experimental systems, in sheep, we've gotten quite good at sealing the cribriform plate, which is a way of kind of blocking a major transport to the olfactory lymphatics. So we can make these pressure measurements in the rat by simultaneously sealing the cribriform plate as a way of starting to investigate whether there is any kind of interaction between an absorption deficit, at least at this level, and the pressures that we measure up here. So we're working towards perhaps an hypothesis, maybe a two-hit hypothesis. I'd like to believe that impaired CSF absorption has some relevance to hydrocephalus. Certainly, clinically, people have measured elevated outflow resistance in many forms of hydrocephalus. Experimentally, that's also true. So whether this has no relevance or whether impaired absorption just makes everything worse, we don't know. But we hopefully can begin to address these issues using this sort of rat model. One last point before I finish is that Rolf Reed has determined that there are a number of drugs that can completely abrogate this beta-1 integrin effect. Alpha-trinositol is one of them. It's an anti-inflammatory drug that, when given in his experimental system intravenously, blocks the disruption of the beta-1 integrins that he induces with the various forms of perturbations that I talked about. And this is kind of exciting because it raises the possibility of developing, if the concept has any merit at all, and it may not, but if it does, it raises the possibility of developing some pharmacological strategies maybe to prevent the effect. And lastly, the people in the lab who have worked on this project, Diane Armstrong, chief technician, Gurjit Nagra, who's done a lot of the kaolin work, and Laura and Lena, this is the summer student, and you'll notice that they're looking rather upset. That's because this is a very special rat. It wouldn't eat any normal lab chow. It would only eat red Cheerios. So they would have to come in every day and feed this rat red Cheerios, and they got very attached to it. Of course, this is the day of the experiment, and of course, that's why they're upset. I'd also like to point out that the wonderful collaboration that we've had with Pat McAllister's lab, and gratefully acknowledge funding from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research and the Brainchild Foundation. Thank you. Yeah, these are all the sorts of things that we can probably do. Bear in mind that I'm sort of a real old-fashioned physiologist, and molecular biology or all these sophisticated techniques are really tough for me to learn and do, but I'm afraid that my students have been threatening to drag me kicking and screaming into the 21st century, and we're going to have to start measuring things like that. Yeah, I think that if we can get more preliminary data that suggests this is a worthwhile enterprise to follow, we'll have to get much more sophisticated.
As I understand it, you get water going into the paraventricular area to get the lower pressure.
Well, we don't know that. We're talking... That would be the theory, yeah.
But wouldn't that cause brain swelling overall and not hydrocephalus?
Well, it might. Our antibodies are suggesting that the ventricles are expanding. It's really too early to know whether the observation of the ventriculomegaly has anything to do with lowered tissue pressure. Until we actually measure it, we're not going to know. But it's just interesting that we were able to get this effect in a few quick and dirty experiments. I think all I can say is that it's encouraging that we follow it up. But the hypothesis would be that if you lower the periventricular pressure for a suitable period of time, it may cause a pressure gradient. And I guess if it does, we should be able to measure it.
Yeah.
If we can't measure it, then it doesn't exist.
But the gradient may be hard to measure because that could be also a long period of time. But if you get edema in that area,
right,
the total mass of brain tissue will increase.
Right.
And decrease.
Right. Well, right. Well, this is where, you see, in Rolf Reed's instance, he didn't have to worry about a CSF compartment. He just had to worry about the capillary bed. So he was able to negate that, to unmask the lowering effect by shutting down the capillaries. In this particular case, it's tough because I don't know, I mean, if we kill the animal, CSF pressure probably isn't going to go down to zero. What we could do, though, is we could put a catheter in the contralateral ventricle and manipulate the pressure. We can set it wherever we like. We can take it down to zero or even negative by just lowering the reservoir. So we may be able to